Hey y'all, this is Rich Collins of Renaissance Publishing. Welcome to Mardi Gras Beyond the Beads, a series of conversations with Mardi Gras historian Errol Laborde about the history and traditions of Carnival, the greatest free show on earth. Hello everyone, and welcome to Beyond the Beads 2024 series. And Errol, I just want to say happy anniversary. This is our fifth year of doing this together.
Or something like that, yeah. There's three, I guess you call them, major crews that have anniversaries this year. Anniversaries according to the number of years they've been parading. That would be the crew of Carrollton, which centennial, 1924. You know, get back to that one. Crew of Mid-City, 90th anniversary, and crew of Okeanos, 75th anniversary.
Wow.
I don't know what you call this kind of anniversary. Rex has a date anniversary. The first Rex parade was in February 13th, 1872, and of course Mardi Gras is February 13th this year, and so it's not it's really 152 years ago, so it's not that nice, neat year, but I guess you call that an anniversary.
Sure.
So where should I start? I guess Carrollton would be the oldest among these. Carrollton Parade, let me say what was happening, how Mardi Gras grew. All right. In the early days, you had these parades, and they pretty much marched like Rex and Comus and 12th Night Revelers. And they all pretty much paraded as what we think about the business area of St. Charles Avenue, like around where Gallia Hall is. And there were several theaters along there. And they started around there. The first Comus parade started on Julia Street. And so they go in that direction, and then they go to Canal Street, make a loop. Some might cut into the quarter for a couple of blocks, and they come back. But that was pretty much the standard parade route for a long time. Now, as the city grew and the population grew, then the demand and the idea to have parades expanded too. And one area of growth eventually was out toward would be Jefferson Parish. If you imagine like going down St. Charles Avenue, you know, towards the river end and in the Carrollton area, and so. As the city expanded, you'd see crews that would go along with it. Ultimately, there'd be crews in eastern New Orleans, none of which really lasted. I mean, there were some places that even though the city expanded, they really couldn't support a crew. But what we're seeing by 1924 is that kind of expansion going in that direction into the Carrollton area. Fittingly, the first of that group was called Carrollton.
Mm-hmm.
It started in 1924. It started on Oak Street. And a lot of these early crews were like business people in the area. I mean, this wasn't like the image of, you know, the elite people or something like that. This was like business people. Hey, we're starting a parade. You want to join? And, you know, I'll get my cousin to ride and that kind of thing. And so Carrollton was really the pioneer in that. Started on Oak Street. From the beginning, I mean, it was always a nice parade. And then gradually over time, it expanded going down Carrollton toward Canal Street. And they would take a ride on Canal Street. This was as that part of town was developing too more.
So it began at Oak and Carrollton, went all the way through uptown past you know, Claiborne, past Earhart, and then turned right on Canal.
No, they'd head down Carrollton toward Canal Street, and then they go up Canal Street and they make a circle into the business district.
Okay.
And so that became a standard route, and that was like the downtown parade route, and the first week of parades, of really major parades, not these little fly-by-night parades, but the real major parades was always that first Sunday,
mm-hmm.
like the Sunday before Mardi Gras, the Sunday before Bacchus Sunday. And I remember it was a big deal because those went down Canal Street, and so that first weekend was really kind of a focus was on Canal Street. And Carrollton was really the first parade that most people saw every year because it was the first major parade. So what became known as Carrollton Sunday with to a lot of people, the beginning of the parade season. And you have Carrollton that day, and then you also have the crew of Mid-City. And they were both nice parades, and there were people that you know, that really worked to put on a good parade, and they were both kind of landmark parades. In 1933, Mid-City started, and this year it's celebrating its, depending on how you count it, officially it's celebrating its 90th anniversary. And it was started the same sort of story as Carrollton, people in the area saying, you know, let's develop a parade. And Carrollton has always been a really innovative parade. I mean, it's always been one of them. I mean, Mid-City, but Carrollton too, but Mid-City, it's always been an innovative parade. And the sort of innovations that it had, one is the animation. It was the first parade to have some sort of animation where you see these moving objects, these things spinning around, and you'd never seen that before. And the power was Boy Scout power. Somehow they would convince these Boy Scouts to be inside the inside the float, and they'd be turning things and cranks and handles. But you saw animation, which you never saw in a parade. It also was the first and so far the only that really expanded into being all tin foil.
Right.
You know, they always had these brightly, brightly colored foils. Now, some floats have a little bit of foil, but the Carrollton, I mean, the Mid-City Parade has always been a foil parade. And especially being on a Sunday afternoon, if you get a nice, crisp Sunday afternoon with the sun shining and all the reflection. So to me, it's always been the prettiest of the daytime parades, maybe other than Rex. So, all right. The prettiest of the daytime parades, not named Rex. but it's a good parade. It always kind of had a family motif to it. The king and the queen were family. And the themes were more child-oriented themes, like ABCs or the Wizard of Oz. And so it went in a different direction. And that was pretty dramatic because the early crews, like Rex and Comus, had more esoteric themes, you know, legends of Greek mythology. Or,
right.
Or in the case of Rex this year, Lafcadio heard in Japan. I mean, you know, that's not a popular kids thing, but the and so it was fun to look at. It was fun to see the animation. It was dazzling to see the colors. And over time, they added something else called the Greatest Bands in Dixie contest, and they recruited these high school bands from around the South. And if you were a high school band leader in the South, you knew about Mid-City's Greatest Band in the Dixie contest.
Right.
And if you're really into it, into marching and precision and being into it. So it was a big thing to be in that contest. They come from all around. They put them up in military barracks and something. And they'd put up marches along the way, and they'd do these drills. And I remember several times going to see Mid-City parades and watching that. And there was a place along the route where they had judges, and the judges would, you know, be taking grades. And then by the time they got to Gallier Hall, they would announce who the winners were. And I can remember, like, being near Gallier Hall, and right as the band passed Gallier Hall, and seeing the band, and noticed that the band members were crying. I said, what's wrong here, okay? I mean, why are band members crying? Well, the announcement had been made, they didn't win. I mean, they might have been second or third, but they live all year for this. And a lot of these bands, like from small southern towns, they were a big community deal. I mean, to win this was like winning the Super Bowl. But it was a good visual parade to watch. And so you had the tinfoil, you had the animation, you had the popular theme, and then you had the Greatest Bands in Dixie. They don't have Greatest Bands in Dixie anymore. I think it's really a logistic problem. They still have the foil. And there was one float builder in particular who was just like a really specialist, a guy named Ricardo Pusiano, who'd worked for a previous float builder who was a staff member and then was hired to do it. So for several years, he worked on the floats. Nobody else could do what he did. And so this year, then, it's being celebrated as Mid-City's 90th. And then the third is Okeanos. Okeanos, same sort of thing, expanding in you know, business areas and sort of thing, businessmen, you know, let's do a parade. It started in 1939, and this year will be its 75th parade. But the other dynamic that's happening in Mardi Gras during this time, it has a big, big influence, and it started like around 1930 with the completion of the municipal auditorium. That had a big impact because when they built that auditorium, they built it so that it had this center area, which really, you could have two crews having balls simultaneously, the smaller area and then the bigger area. And both of them had a big ball floor and both of them had adequate seating. So it was like, wow, in 1930s, look at this place. And it's like everybody wanted to have a ball in the auditorium. And so that really opened the way. And then when the parades came in, usually they came in from Canal and went up Rampart to the auditorium. The riders could get off right in the back of the auditorium and go in and be part of the. They'd never been that before. I mean, you usually the ball was at a theater somewhere else and all that. And so that was a big innovation. And a lot of crews that didn't have balls started around that time. I think a crew called the Elves of Oberon was the first to use the auditorium. So that period, the 1930s, was really a period of real growth, and you see it also reflected by Mid-City and in Okeanos. So that was a major period.
Based on previous conversations we've had, it's interesting that the Municipal Auditorium came and changed the dynamic and changed roots and changed the way people behaved. Yeah. And then it went away. Rivergate came, same thing. It's been a series of buildings that keep coming along that sort of caused Mardi Gras or Carnival to change and adapt over time.
Yeah, because in the 1960s, it was the Rivergate that made Bacchus possible. When these guys were planning, and you know, you never had a parade. I mean, you had a parade go to the back of an auditorium, but you never even actually go into an auditorium, especially when it's a humongous parade like Bacchus would be. But when they were designing it, and the guys who were designing Bacchus said, you know, we really need to do something different. Mardi Gras getting a little dull. We need to do something visually spectacular. So they built these huge floats, and then somebody, I think it might have been Blaine Kern, because at the same time they're building the Rivergate, say, you know, let's go see those freight doors. And they put in a real lobbying effort to make those freight doors big enough that the float could go in.
Right.
And then once that happened, that those floats could in, well, that was a sensation. So all of a sudden you have a party for 2,000 people. I mean, it was really a hot ticket. And this wasn't like an old society ball. This wasn't by invitation. It was something that you bought tickets for, or more often the guy who was riding would invite you and family, you know, and buy tickets. And so you'd see the parade go through, and then there'd be a buffet.
Not to get too off topic, but you know, everything now heads toward the convention centers. We've got the convention center, we have the Superdome, these massive buildings nobody could have conceived of, let's say, back when the Municipal Auditorium was built. But the Rivergate, remind me, what happened? Why did the Rivergate have a end date? What happened to the Rivergate?
Well, gambling, okay. When the whole gambling thing came through, And that was a big issue, and I guess it was in the 70s or so, about being able to have a big land-based casino. At the time, New Orleans was allowed to have one land-based casino. There were several riverboat casinos, but they could have one big one. And whoever got the license for that, and there was Harrah's competing and Caesars and different people. I mean, imagine having the only casino in downtown New Orleans, right? And being able to do that. And that became the prime spot, all right? Some people said, well, that's fine, okay, but let's just convert the Rivergate into a casino. And the mayor, Mayor Bartholomew, and he was criticized for it, but in retrospect, from an economic development sense, I think he was right. He says, no, we got to tear it down and build a new building, which created a lot of jobs, and it was like an economic boost. It was kind of the death knell for the auditorium, certainly for balls, but it was a big project. There's a lot of debate about the Rivergate. Some people say, oh, it's so beautiful. I personally didn't like it very much. if you walked along the Poydra Street side on one side, the Canal Street side, and the other side, what do you thought? You walk along blank walls.
Yeah.
Right? There wasn't anything. The one thing they say, well, yeah, but look at the ceiling, that they have this half-barrel vault architecture. And so, like, if you're looking down, if you were on the top of One Shell Square and you look down, you saw a ceiling, if you can imagine, barrels that is shaped like a bunch of barrels cut in half. I mean, that's what it looked like.
Yeah.
And it kind of has a wavy look. And so people, architectural critics, thought that roof was kind of interesting and liked it, but it was a boring building, and it really didn't.
And I guess it became expendable, too, because of the convention center and the super, all these other things had been built.
Yeah, yeah. But the Rivergate made it happen, all right?
Yeah, I mean, it was thing, important.
Yeah, yeah. There's a story that Bacchus was doing this for a few years. I mean, they were the first to do it. And a man in Gentilly had a parade called the Nimbion. And it was a small neighborhood parade. But he wanted to enhance it. He wanted to build it. He wanted it to be more like a Bacchus parade. But he really didn't know much about the ball. And then Blaine Kern, the float designer, said, hey, look, I want you to come with me to the Bacchus ball this Sunday. And Ed Muniz was as much of a P.T. Barnum kind of guy as Wayne Kern was. These are guys who thought big. You know, oh, right. We could do that, we could do that, okay. And when Ed Muniz saw what Bacchus was doing, at that time was in the Rivergate, he said, oh, we could do this, man, we could do that. And so as the convention center, started playing the convention center, and of course the Superdome, in both of them. I mean, that was part of the ingrained thought that you have, okay? You know, if you can build a building that big, that can stage something that big, make it big enough to have floats in. So that was the beginning of a new era. In the years past, I guess at that point you thought, man, that's a big explosion in balls now. But, what happened is that the Municipal Auditorium still hasn't opened. It was still the best place for a regular-sized ball. It did have the best floor-line views. It was better than being in a big cavern. But that scene hasn't come back. And the smaller crews can't go into the River Gate, the convention center. And so usually they're going to hotels, they're going to a country club.
Right.
But it's not the same thing. It's not the same the same feeling that they had.
Right. Wait, so you covered, did I divert you from the third cruise celebrating its anniversary, or did you cover everything you needed to say there?
Yeah, I think we talked about this. I could talk about Rex, though.
Well, before you switch to Rex, I just want to mention one thing. You talked about Mid-City and Carrollton, and something that I know. This is my 33rd year here, and I miss the era that was here when I got here, when Mid-City and Carrollton rolled down Canal Street, and I lived on Canal Street, and I had a balcony in the front of my house, and so that was a huge, a big change is when all those Mid-City parades left.
Yeah, it was a big loss. A lot of people lamented. I mean, it was just a wonderful scene when you had some parades going down Canal Street, and then most ultimately taking the uptown route, and then you had some like Ferret was obviously in the Ferret neighborhood, and so you had some that were a little bit more targeted. What happened ultimately was the police. And you know, you talk about kings and captains. Ultimately, who rules the Mardi Gras is the police, okay? And the police really needed standardized routes in terms of distributing officers along the way, and also like barricades.
Barricades.
Because there were getting to be more and more incidents where people rushed the floats and got hit by the floats. And so they started having barricades all along the route. And so once you barricade the entire route, I mean, it's not something like, let's move to that parade now. So they had to standardize. But the other thing that was happening is that some of the crews were struggling a little bit. I mean, you know, people say, I've done this before, but it's okay. And but the canal, the St. Charles route is what I call Carnival's Broadway. I mean, it is the prettiest route. It is the route if you're trying to convince somebody, if they've been marching in a suburban parade down some little truck highway or something, says, come right along St. Charles Avenue. Got all those oak trees.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful sight. You usually have a good crowd. I mean, if you just have the university students alone, you got a good crowd. But there's a lot of people that live around there, and a lot of people who live around there who have been going to Carnival parades all their lives. And so if you're paying for it, if you want the visual bang, okay,
yeah,
then the St. Charles route is it's where you want
to
be.
That makes a lot of sense from pitching it to potential riders. St. Charles is the deluxe quintessential New Orleans experience.
Yeah, and that really became the bargaining point that captains would have to use. Also, what happened during this period is the advent of Bacchus and then Endymion and then Orpheus, they all absorbed a lot of riders in there, okay? And they really hurt the suburban parades because a lot of their riders... I'd bet like a crew like Endymion that most of the riders come from Jefferson Parish. Right. I mean, the founder was the past mayor of Kenner and all that. And so they had a lot of riders. And they hurt a lot of the small crews. But in return, I mean, the city got a big spectacular parade. And Bacchus got the best of both worlds. He can do that. And plus, he goes down St. Charles Avenue. Endymion. You can't have Endymion and Bacchus on the same weekend. It's just too much of an overload. And so Endymion actually controls Canal Street now, where once there were a lot of parades, there's one. There was Endymion on that Saturday before. But I can tell you that as someone who lives along there, Endymion is a multiple-day event.
Yes.
The parade's on Saturday, and I guess by Wednesday you start seeing people moving in and
ladders intense
and all that. And the day of Endymion is just it really excites me. I always tell people this is what urban living should be like. When you see all these people walking by, you see porch bands and smell barbecue and all that, and
other things.
By. I think it's a wonderful event.
Well, it's funny. I lived in Mid-City for 2 decades, let's say, and then I've been uptown for about a decade and a half. And So I'm very familiar with Endymion, have essentially gone every year, and I miss all the other parades. But I noticed there's definitely a different attitude about Endymion if you live uptown, because it's hard to get to. It's competing with other iconic parades uptown. So there's almost a I can't even be bothered with it feeling for people who live uptown. Whereas every year I always make the effort. We leave early, we go park, we find our friend's house, and we just make it a day, you know?
Yeah, if you live uptown and you want to make Endymion, you can do it, but it's tough.
It's tough.
Yeah, if you got a bike, that's probably the best.
I have to interject, Producer Kelly here.
Hey, Producer.
I have seen Errol on Endymion Saturday and can confirm he is 100% in his element. That is Errol's best day of the year. His house is decked out. Their porch next door has a band on it, and it is ready to go. It's the best spot in town.
It's a good feeling. And we have a deal with our neighbor that we split the cost for a porch band.
Awesome.
So he hires them. The St. Claude Serenaders, okay, is the name of the band. Nice. But they're a great band. And so that part of the day is really a good feeling. Actually, the parade itself, I mean, it's exciting when it comes, but it's a long time passing.
Yeah, by the time it gets to you, it's probably not over till 9 or 10.
So usually by around mid-parade, I'm kind of ready to go back to the house and have some pie, you know. So, but it's, I just think it's a great experience.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so that was you mourning the loss of those other Mid-City parades, and then, I'm sorry, you were going to talk about Rex's pseudo-anniversary.
Well, only the... The first Rex Parade was on February 13th, 1872. This year's is February 13th, but the years are it's not the same gaps in years and all that. But that was a parade. That's fairly early. I mean, February 13th is early. Apparently it was planned from what we know, maybe like around October or November. And the St. Charles Hotel was like the business and cultural center of New Orleans. So they've got to make it the St. Charles Hotel. That's where the Bank One building is now. And so they had meetings, and there's stories about these guys sitting over drinks and planning it. And what they wanted was there'd always been some kind of miscellaneous parades on Mardi Gras, but there was nothing really organized, nothing substantial. And so they really wanted to develop a parade. The rumor's always been that it was developed because the Grand Duke Alexis came to town, but that wasn't the reason they started Rex. I mean, it happened, he was coming to town, but they would have started Rex regardless. This was during Reconstruction, and cities all across the South wanted to get out of that malaise. I mean, they wanted to get back into the economy, into the mainstream of life. And so that's what they were really doing. They were trying to do something that was an economic development, or draw people back into the cities, you know, to have an event.
You'd mentioned before that, you know, with the railroads too, that it was an excuse to get on a train.
That was really key, and I think it's only recently that people realized the importance of the railroads. I mean, I'd always heard, and it's true, that the railroads would put up flyers along the route, you know, come to Mardi Gras and see the parade of the King of Carnival. They didn't call him Rex yet, but the King of the Carnival. But really, ultimately, what would happen all across the... The first transcontinental railroad was signed into law by Lincoln. I think it was, 1868 or something. And so at that time, the transcontinental railroad was being built. Railroads were being built all over. But once you build railroads, you got to have a reason for people to take them.
Right.
And so railroads became really, really active in doing promotions, you know, coming through the city. And not just in parades, you know, the story about the national parks. If they were building those transcontinental parades, you know, railroads going from Chicago across to Washington, California. Well, why, okay? And so the railroads had a lot to do to start, I think, Glacier National Park. Ultimately, Yellowstone has a place where the railroads would arrive. So they became a huge impetus for spreading. And not only that, we've noticed is that if you look at the European parades, you know, there's always a story about that the Rex captain, when he hired Blaine Kern to be the designer, he sent him to this town called Via Reggio in Italy to study float design. I'd heard about Via Reggio, you know, for a long time, and I thought it was some kind of ancient parade, but it started around the same time. I think a couple of years after Rex.
Wow.
Right?
Wow.
But what was happening, the same thing was in Europe. They were building, I mean, the technology, the funding was there now. Yeah, it's true that Rex learned float design from Via Reggio, but I bet people from Via Reggio had come to New Orleans and seen Rex a couple of years, and so they all borrow from each other. Even at a lower level, the street corps lines, there was a line, the Canal Street, Lakefront Street Corps line, and it used to go down Canal Street toward Jefferson Parish, but then turn up, like I think on West End, and go all the way down to the lake. And they built a little amusement park there.
Right.
And so that was the idea, okay, to encourage business, to encourage development. And I knew a man as a young man. He worked at one of the hotels, I think the old Hotel New Orleans, but he had a lot of off time. And so sometimes on his off time, he'd get in a streetcar and ride down to the lakefront and just see that, and come back. And so railroads in many different ways and in many different places were important in creating, increasing destinations.
Right. And so that's the context in which Rex, 152 years ago on February 13th, had its first role.
And the other thing, the Venice Parade, the Venice Parade goes maybe like in 1200 or something, But there was a long time they didn't have it, all right? Then during the Napoleonic era, Napoleon didn't believe in religion, he didn't believe anything related to religion, he didn't believe in ceremony. So for a long time, there wasn't the Venice, the formal celebration of Mardi Gras. It started to develop again, I think it was in the 1970s, they created something about they created a parent organization, like the Venice Mardi Gras Association. And so I was kind of curious, what year it started. And I looked around. And the time it was created was around the same time that international jet flights were coming into existence, all right? And so you can imagine you're sitting around a table in Venice and said, if we could start a parade, you got those international flights. And where are they coming from? From the United States, okay? So you can get that market going back and forth. And so the nonstop international flights were the new railroads, and I think that did the same thing.
That makes sense. Fueled a whole next wave. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So that is a brief history of the three parades that are celebrating their anniversaries this year. Errol Laborde, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom.
Thank you.
As always, if anybody has any questions or comments, just send me an email, errol@mynewOrleans.com. And for the subject line, put Mardi Gras Podcast. So I'll know not to delete you.